Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we are flashing back to November 17th, 2011. This was originally episode 793. Zach Baker on Wilderness Survival, Survival Myths, and Urban Reality. It's a great discussion. I will let you know that Zach had a website called befoundalive.com, and I checked it out. And again, we've been doing this a long time, and we're well past a decade since we did this episode. Life changes, things move on, and that website doesn't exist anymore. So if you go look for it and you find something, it ain't it. That's all I can say. I can't tell you what you're looking at, but it ain't it. It just is a thing. And whenever I have these episodes like this and we talk about that fact, I always try to remind people that, like, this is actually a really good case for, if you're going to put time and effort into something, you probably need to monetize it in some way so that it will at least have enough income that it'll be worth, like, maintaining a website for, even if you kind of change the way the website appears or what have you. Because I find that most of the time when these sites disappear, that's what it is that person stopped pursuing it as a profit, and since they weren't making any money off it, it wasn't worth, $20 to $100 a year to keep it online, when the reality is if you build of anything with any kind of value in it, you should be able to make some money, even if it's a few hundred bucks. Why would you shut something off that makes you a few hundred bucks? So if you're building a website or something like that, think about different ways to monetize it. Now, your first goal is to make it pay for itself. Your next goal should be, I'm not talking about a business that you're going to live off of right away anyway. We're talking about a side hustle. First thing, make it pay for itself. Second thing, make it pay for one of your smaller bills. Third thing, make it pay for one of your middle bills. The fourth thing, get it to pay your mortgage. If you can have a side hustle that covers your mortgage, you kind of sort of live basically rent-free, mortgage-free, even while you're still servicing that debt, unless you're, if you're working three times as hard for the same amount of money on your side hustle as your job, you got to work something out there. Just kind of giving you some level of impetus to think about if you're going to build an online thing, a social media presence, think about monetization, and especially with social media, think beyond the Google ads and stuff like that, because it will never be reliable, even if the money is good. That can always be taken away from you. Anyway, let's talk about some survival myths versus reality with Zach Baker, flashing back November 17, 2011.
I got all the housekeeping taken care of. I'd like to introduce our guest now. His name is Zach Baker. Again, he refounded a school and gear shop called Be Found Alive back in 2003, and he did that because, like, he's like me. He grew up with this stuff, and he has a really big love for the outdoors, learning about native cultures. As a kid, he was searching for arrowheads and stuff like that. Spent a lot of dirt time out there, and that lifetime of spending the dirt time is what resulted in founding the school again, befoundalive.com. Great guy. Met him first out in Salt Lake City, Utah at the Preparedness Expo, and he was interested in coming on the show, and so we have him here today. Hey, Zach, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Yeah, glad to be here, Jack.
Hey, so I met you out in Salt Lake City and at the Preparedness Expo out there. And you came to me and you told me you have this this school called Be Found Alive. And you told me a little bit about what the school is about, what you teach out there. You want to just kind of give like a little bit of an overview for people as to, you know, what is Be Found Alive all about?
If Be Found Alive is the product of years of working in the I've worked in the outdoor business for a long time. I've been teaching in the outdoors, and what happened was is I just continually kept coming back to I started learning wilderness survival and self-reliance in general when I was growing up. I had grandparents who grew up there during the Depression, and you know, we made our own soap. We were into permaculture. Of course, that's what we didn't call it that then. But, you know, I grew up with this self-reliant mindset, being, I guess, taught to me, you know, until I was 20. And I got into the teaching in the outdoors, while I was in college. And I just kept finding myself being drawn back to wilderness survival and backcountry safety. And so over the years, that has evolved into what we do now, which is befoundalive.com, is my website. It's basically our web presence that promotes self-reliance, wilderness survival. We teach everything from primitive technology to being more self-reliant in your home. Pretty broad range of skills that we're out there promoting. But more importantly, I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to teach people to be more self-reliant in their lives in general. You know, whether that means, you know, getting out of debt, having food storage, or having, you know, being prepared for a wilderness outing. It's a pretty broad range of topics that we're really shooting for.
But yeah, you know, here's my thoughts. And maybe it's just the industry I'm in now and doing the show every day, but I'm seeing more and more people that are like, going to take up hunting or take up fishing. And I think that's great, but it also makes me think back to, you know, like when I was a kid, we used to call it Up County in Pennsylvania, you know, just going northern the state and you call it Up County or whatever. But we would, you know, we'd go bear hunting and we'd be out there for 3 days. And we put this little kit together. We had all this stuff in case something went wrong while we were out there, from first aid gear to being able to start a fire. Simple stuff like extra food, lip balm, stuff because you're up in that cold wind. And then I think about the person that maybe is taking up hunting, which means they've never done it before, and they're going to go out into that environment, and most of them really, it's not like you grew up with it, I grew up with it. When you started out, I'm sure you had, you know, a dad or an uncle or a big brother at your side, and you get taught all this stuff, and by the time you're kind of on your own with it a little bit, you know what you're doing. And I'm actually really concerned for a lot of the new outdoorsmen, I guess I would call them, that are rediscovering this, if they don't take the skill set of looking after for themselves, you know, while they're out there. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's funny because the last statistics I saw, they were put out by the outdoor recreation industry, stated that there were 140 million participants in our nation that are into some type of outdoor activity. Now, that activity may be bird watching down at the local park. It may be fishing. It may be hunting. It may be skiing. But that's a lot of people in our nation that are participating in some type of outdoor activity. And what's really astonished me is, you know, I've done a lot of work for the Wild Turkey Federation over the years, and hunting organizations, and what really surprises me is I'll be sitting in a room full of very experienced hunters, people who've hunted in Africa and in parts of the world that most people haven't even heard of, and these guys don't know how to treat water to make it potable. They don't know how to start a fire without gasoline and a Bic lighter. Now, those are foundational skills. Those are requirements for us to live. And I think some of it goes back, Jack, to, you know, in our nation, and I don't want to bash anything technological wise, but we become so addicted to technology. You know, I think it's funny. I follow several online survival forums. And it's often, there's often this game that's played out in these forums. let's see who can create the smallest, most compact survival kit. Well, you know what? When the chips are down, I don't want to depend on something that fits in my front pocket. I want to have something that's going to provide me with a little more than a base comfort level if I'm stuck in the wilderness. We never saw, you know, mountain men in the Old West. Very rarely, you know, these guys would have mule trains full of supplies. And they lived in the wilderness for months and months and years on end. So...
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. The little pocket kits and stuff like that, they actually scare the hell out of me. I mean, when they first started coming out, I was like, well, that's kind of cool and that's kind of neat. Then I started to realize that, you know, I would hear comments from somebody like, I've got my kit, and I'm like, wow, if you think you're really going to be able to make do with that in a true, not even maybe a, in fact, I would almost put it this way, that kit could take what could be a pleasant outing in the woods and turn it into a survival situation if you think it's going to get you by.
Exactly. Well, you know, a big part of what I've always been taught and which influences what I teach and what I write about is the rule of three. You know, I remember learning this when I was 16, and it's really influenced, you know, what I do. And I'm sure you're familiar with the rule of threes, but for your listeners, it's basically you can survive 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without shelter or warmth, 3 days without a water, and 3 weeks without food. And obviously, it's just that those are guidelines, because if I'm in Death Valley and it's 120, you know, that order is going to be a bit skewed. But I use that as kind of a general rule in building survival kits, in teaching outdoor skills, because if I have an understanding that, you know, exposure is going to kill me quicker than anything else, then I'm going to prepare for that, which is my worst enemy. And there's all these commercial kits available that don't address those priorities. You know, it's funny because people immediately, these new kits come out and people immediately start talking about, you know, the water container is a condom. There's a razor blade for a knife. And then there's you know, there's nothing by way of shelter. Well, even for, you know, trained, seasoned survival instructors, building a shelter out of raw materials in the wilderness is extremely difficult, because most people don't realize they're in a bad situation until it's too late, until they're hurt, until they're lost, until it's dark. You know, that's the problem, I think, with a lot of the self-perpetuating survival, you know, hooey that's running rampant out there, you know, and it's propagated by television shows and survival books, which aren't written by survival experts. They're written by, you know, some Joe Schmo who's been commissioned to, you know, produce a book for the publisher, you know, because survival's a hot topic.
Yeah, and the books are one thing, but what really goes over the edge are some of the TV scenarios, and I think that they're going to get worse, not better, from the people I've talked to from Nat Geo, that I'm just like, I can't even talk to you people. I really can't. The one producer there, I told him, don't even call me. As blunt as I could, and I think there is a lot of like myth put up there, but you brought up a really big, hot thing with me. Personally, all this gear and stuff, we can debate what's good and what's bad. But when it really comes down to it, it's that these things are going to – you have to do them in a state where it usually is too late by the time we're going to call it a survival situation. You're building a shelter, because if you don't get a shelter built now, you might very well freeze to death tonight or die of heat exposure today. And you're in that situation, and then fear starts to take over. And I think that the biggest thing that people need before they're going to engage in these activities that might put them there – is the right mindset. So in your view, what's the mindset of a survivor, and what kind of techniques can people use to help control panic and fear?
Well, you know, we hear it all the time, you know, survival begins between our ears. You know, it's not so much what we're carrying as what we know. You know, a lot of shelter building, fire creation, those are based on principles that once mastered are relatively easy to apply to other, for example, the bow drill. If you or using a flint and steel, if you can create a friction fire, and if you can do that consistently, you can, in my book, you can make a fire pretty much with anything, because it requires such finesse and knowledge to do and skill. You know, it's not only a set of skills and concepts that we need to know, but it's a mindset. You know, there have been many instances here in the West, where, people have found themselves in bad situations and literally given up and laid down and died. I remember a few years back, there was a hunter that, here in Utah, and he was out hunting. He found himself lost, and in a sheer panic, he dropped his pack, he dropped his firearm, he took his jacket off, and ran in a sprint through the forest. And, well, that hunter was found the following spring, and he, you know, obviously by that point he was bones. He was gone. So, you know, the ability to control the fear and panic is crucial. So what I've come up with is a concept called the survivor's mantra. Now, you know, a mantra, you know, the technical definition of a mantra is the sound or a syllable, a group of words. It's an affirmation. It's something that we repeat, that it's repeated over and over in our minds, and in essence what we're doing is we're occupying our thoughts so we don't allow the creeping in of the panic. But they have found, you know, scientists have found that simply by repeating a phrase over and over again, it's not so much it determines or it creates a different reality for us. And sure, it affects us on a physical level. So
what would be an example of that? I mean, a phrase we use for that.
Okay, well, so the survivor's mantra is basically, it's something that you choose for yourself. And and if you don't want to choose one, something as simple as "I'm a survivor, I'm a survivor, I'm a survivor," is you find something short and sweet, something that you can really wrap your head around and put some faith into. I know for myself, you know, I typically every summer will take a trip by myself into the wilderness to test my skills, and you know, I find myself naturally drifting to thoughts of my family. Everything else kind of falls away. I don't think about my work. I don't think about anything, bills. I don't think anything along those lines, but I think about my family. So for me, a positive mantra for me would be, you know, I'll see my family soon. I'll see my family soon. And simply by committing ourselves to that mantra and repeating it in our minds, you know, we see a shifting in our consciousness and an ability to control that fear which builds up and inside. Have you ever felt that fear, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to be completely dishonest with anybody, you know, asking a question, have you ever felt serious fear for your own safety before, and to say no, of course you have.
Yeah. I remember when I was a teenager, I got lost in a mine, and it was my light went out. Of course, I was a teenager, so I wasn't very smart. I only had one light with me. My light went out, and I got lost, and I felt that panic welling up inside, and with it comes the shakes, inability to think clearly because of the hormonal dump of adrenaline that comes with that fear and panic. And so, at the time, what saved me was my ability to to focus on higher power and allowed me to get out of that situation. But my whole life, I think back to that one, and I just, that one circumstance, and that sense of fear just was so overwhelming and overpowering. And so that was kind of the impetus for the survivor's mantra. Mantras have been used by different religions and philosophies for thousands of years as a way to help people focus on becoming a better, their higher self or God or whatever you want to focus on.
Here's what it makes me think of. I've always tried to tell people that, like, one of my core tenets is what you do matters. You know, that oncologists will say that two cancer patients, one is a pain in the ass, the other one just is a willing patient, and both of them end up doing the same thing. The one that was a pain in the ass lives more often than the compliant one because they know what they do matters. And by focusing on that concept of even taking the step of doing it, you're also reinforcing to yourself that your actions are important. And I know what you mean by the fear, because, I mean, I just can think back, you know, hunting as a kid, and you see the ridge line, you know, the road's up there. And so you go up there, and that's not the ridge where the road is. And you're even in an area you've been in most of your life, and you know you're going to find your way out. But at first you're thinking, oh, crap, where the hell am I? And it's really easy to kind of take off in a direction you think you need to go and let that fear override you. And I think sometimes it could be that this type of a mantra thing is really good for a long-term survival situation. But in many instances, the only reason you end up in a long-term survival situation, and by that I mean more than a day, is because you let the fear overtake you and did something stupid instead of just stopping and thinking and getting rational and saying, hold on, if I've only been out for 15 minutes, I can't be more than 15 minutes away from where I started.
Yeah.
So unless I take off in a blind want run for 30 minutes, I'm probably going to be okay.
For sure, for sure. Well, not only that, but if you use the old acronym STOP, which, you know, anytime you find yourself in a bad situation, you should apply that, which is stop, think, and my version of STOP is a little different. The traditional, I think, is stop, think, observe, and plan. My version of it is stop, think, organize, and plan. So organize your resources, make a plan, and carry it out. But the simple act of stopping is and sitting down, you know, stopping. You find yourself lost, that panic coming on, stop and sit down. And the simple act of stopping physiologically is going to start to calm your nerves. It's that pacing that really, the pacing and the, you know, giving in, I guess, to the hormonal dump that's going on that really, I think, doesn't allow us to focus in on what we need to be focusing in on and doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, in your notes that you sent me before the interview, you also mentioned something called autogenic breathing. You want to chat about that for a bit?
Yeah. Okay, so autogenic breathing is a technique that's been used in our military for many years. And what it is it's a breathing technique that I think dovetails perfectly with the survivor's mantra. But what autogenic breathing is just a breathing technique used to control fear. They also call it combat breathing. It's taught to, snipers will use it. And what it does is it does just what we were talking about. It allows you to control that hormonal dump, the jitters that come with it. It allows us to keep our heart rate down. And what autogenic breathing is basically a breathing technique where, you know, you find yourself in a lot of times, you know, we think of, meditational techniques. You know, we think of some guy, some new age guy sitting in some place with candles and tapestries. But, you know, autogenic breathing is something that we can do in any stressful situation. You know, whether it's dealing with somebody at work that we don't get along with our, you know, spouses, or with a survival situation. And what it is it's a technique where you breathe in for a count of three, you hold it for 3 seconds, and then you breathe out for a count of three. and you continue that process. So when you want to start that process is when you start feeling those jitters, when you start feeling your heart rate increase, and you can do this. For as long as necessary. It's easy. It's something that's very, it's almost too easy. It's one of those things like, wait, how's that going to help me? Well, it will. By simply focusing on your breathing in and out for three, you know, that's going to, you'll notice a marked difference after a minute or two. You'll be able to maintain and, control that, the panic.
I was thinking that makes an awful lot of sense, and I imagine it's one of the things you do teach your students.
Yes, correct. Correct.
Very, very cool. So, I mean, you're a survival trainer, and, you know, you do focus a lot on the wilderness aspects, and so to think we would get through an interview where we wouldn't talk about the rule of threes is just completely ridiculous, because it's something that's a core fundamental to the entire thing. But you want to maybe talk a little bit about how it applies to a person's emergency preps, not just for wilderness survival, but maybe additionally urban survival.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, Jack, where we met at the Preparedness Expo there in Salt Lake, I wandered around looking at all the booths, and boy, there were sure a lot of people selling, survival trinkets and, buy your year food supply. I know a lot of people in Utah here that are prepared simply because it's taught by the predominant religion here. Being prepared is kind of a core fundamentalist, something that they've taught for years. I talk to these people and I look at their preparations, and they have got, you know, rooms full of freeze-dried food and canned goods and all of this, useful stuff, don't get me wrong, but they don't have a way to heat their homes. They don't have extra fuel to heat their homes or for their vehicles. They aren't prepared for the event of having to abandon their homes. Here in Utah, the big one that everybody keeps talking about here, our potential natural disaster is a earthquake. And they keep telling us it's going to come. It's not when or if, it's when it comes. And so I've seen statistics that show that if there was a, 8.0 earthquake in Salt Lake City, that majority of the homes in this valley would be flattened or uninhabitable. Well, if all of your food supply is in your basement and the house is on top of it, what good does it do you? But more importantly, how the rule of three really fits in is it helps in your preparation. If you have all the food in the world and 1,000 gallons of water in your basement, but yet you don't have the means to warm your home, to keep your family, warm, properly clothed, then that food storage is really not worth anything, correct?
Well, absolutely, because you'll freeze to death before you starve to death in any situation.
Yeah. Well, and it's not a myth, but it's a core belief in outdoor survival is, exposure is the number one killer in the outdoors, and that's heat and cold exposure. How many summers in a row do we hear about in Europe where thousands of people die because there's a heat wave? We tend to overlook those type of, we think exposure strictly as a cold weather phenomena, but exposure also is heat related as well.
Yeah, I mean, with the heat thing, a lot of times when I talk to people and they say, well, what should we get? A lot of times I'll say, well, you probably, especially when people have young kids, you probably at least want to get like a base generator, decent generator, and a window unit air conditioner. Like, oh, I'm worried about the apocalypse, if you just have power out for a couple weeks and you have an infant, right? And you can be all the tough guy you want to be, but that doesn't mean that your family is going to be tough or your mother-in-law that's 86 years old and lives with you.
And I think a lot of people, like, when they get all the tough guy bravado survival thing going on in their head, they forget that the whole, that you mentioned your family is part of your mantra. I'm going to see my family again. The whole reason you're trying to survive is so that you can take care of your family. You know, if you didn't have them, it wouldn't be that, it wouldn't be as important to you if you were the only person here. And that means we have to think about things more in a team mindset. You might be the team leader because you're the one who cares, but then you have to compensate for the inadequacies of the other people around you.
Yeah. Well, you know, something that, in work, I've been into mountaineering for a lot of years, and we always pace any type of climbing trip. You always base your pace on the slowest member of your party. So survival preparations should be the same. You should accommodate the least skilled, the youngest, the oldest member of your family when making those preparations.
And I think that includes, like, if we go out on a camping trip, right, then we got to do the same thing. So it might be that now we don't have an 86-year-old mother-in-law with us, or maybe it's not something where we brought the toddler, but if we have a group of guys getting together, and I think a lot of times this creates survival situations, get that healthy competition attitude going, and we really need to be thinking about not pushing it. So if you're the star athlete and you've got the guy with you that, you know, it would take a lot just to get him out there with you, you know, the best case scenario, you're going to make him miserable, he's never going to want to go again. Worst case scenario, you're going to both end up in a bad situation because one of you pushed the other one too far.
Yeah, true.
So you were mentioning some myths. What are some of your favorites? I'll give you one of mine to kick it off. This is the number one myth. I think I'm going to make a YouTube video about this because I'm ready to pull my flipping hair out. I talk a lot about the homesteading stuff and all, and I'll mention rabbits. And every time I mention a rabbit, I get this rabbit starvation bullshit. I'm sorry. That's the only word I can describe it, right? So, you know, if you eat just too much protein and not enough fat, you're going to die. And it's like, okay, it's not completely a myth. So my understanding of the genesis of this is there were some people stuck up in the mountains that tried to live on rabbit, and it wasn't enough. And, you know, like, eventually they succumbed to starvation, and it's been labeled rabbit starvation. Well, I look at it too. If you're in the mountains in the middle of the winter and there's nothing else for you to forage for, there's very little for the rabbit. So we've got a starving person eating a starving rabbit, and we're going to be in a very fat deficient state, and fat deficiency will kill you quicker, certainly than protein deficiency, and much faster than carbohydrate deficiency. There's societies that live on nothing but fat and protein, Eskimo, for example. So you can do without the carbs. You've got to have fat, and you will die without fat. That's not a myth. But the concept that if I ate a rabbit a day for a week, all of a sudden I'm going to be sick, it drives me crazy. The thought that somebody might actually be in a survival situation and be able to acquire a rabbit and think in some way that's bad drives me nuts. And so that's one of my favorite all-time myths, and I think I'll get some statistics and caloric intake and all and put out a YouTube video on that. But what are some of your maybe favorite or maybe the better way to say is most hated survival myths?
You know, Jack, I see in the survival genre, I see different, there's obviously divisions. You have people who are coming at survival from a military standpoint. You have people who are, you know, the bush hippie type people who are coming at it strictly from a primitive standpoint, a little more earth-based. And you have your, and they're teaching, you know, or I'm sorry, what they're promoting is more of a long-term living situation. They're not per se, addressing a short-term, unexpected night out, that kind of thing. I think some of the things that really get me is we talked about the pocket-sized, survival kits. I think that's ridiculous.
You mean I can't survive on a tea bag and a bouillon cube?
Yeah. Putting condoms as a water carrier. You know, what's the old saying about condoms? One prick and they're useless.
Yeah.
Well, that applies even more so if your water supply is dependent on these things. But I think probably the biggest myth that gets me is the space blanket. Technically.
Oh, yeah. You mean the potato chip bag?
Yeah, the Mylar film is technically not a blanket by the true definition of what a blanket is. And most people don't know this, but the space blanket is perishable. I had one in my trunk for a few years. I'm sorry, it was behind the seat in the back of my truck. I left it in there on purpose, unopened, in a bag. It was in there for about 2 years, and I went to open that thing, and I couldn't even get the thing open. The aluminization flakes off. The thin polyester film becomes yellow and brittle, and you can't even get it open. So, I cannot pick up a survival magazine or book or video without them talking about space blankets. And I can't tell you how many people I know who have a stockpile of space blankets just in case, And it just boggles my mind. Now, granted, there are some uses of the space blanket that make it an effective tool, but as something that you can wrap around your body that will reflect 90% of your body heat, what a bunch of hooey.
Well, my question is always about what about the 50% or actually more like 70% of loss that's going through your body into the ground? You're generally losing, and if you don't even know the skill set to prevent that, you're generally losing more of your heat through ground contact than you are through air contact. You notice the air contact because you feel it more, but the actual draw out of the body is through that conduction to the cold ground.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever tried to actually use one of those when it does work, but it's like sleeping in a giant Ruffles bag. So you're trying to sleep in a stress situation, right? Let's say best case scenario, you don't put a hole in it, you do make a ground layer, and you do get it over top of you. You're scared as hell, you're out in the middle of nowhere, you're trying to get a little bit of sleep while you can so that when the sun comes up you can think, and every time you so much as breathe, you hear crinkle, crinkle, crackle.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't do it. You can't sleep with one of those things. I'm sorry. Now, I don't know how you feel. I do like the stuff that's lined with that sort of that type of material that's more of a tarp.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I like that a lot. That's actually pretty effective. It's a pretty effective tool, but they're more substantial. What I was going to say about the sound, if you did everything right, if before your trip you left a itinerary with somebody, with at least three people, and the rescuers are out looking for you, you're hunkered up underneath a tree somewhere, and even if there's the slightest breeze, man, you can't hear somebody talking next to you if you're wrapped in a space blanket. So
you know what? You're absolutely right.
How are you going to be able to hear anybody? You couldn't hear a helicopter that was, unless it was right on top of you,
You're absolutely right. I've never thought about that. I mean, but that's the truth. Because, you got muffled stuff in the woods and you're huddled up and you're, especially if you're tired, you've been out there for a couple of days and somebody's yelling, yo, you're not, unless they're standing directly next to you and you already see them, you're not going to hear it.
No, you're not. Now, where they are effective is they were developed by the space industry to reflect radiant heat away from spacecraft, the aerospace industry. They are very effective as a fire reflector, a heat reflector behind a fire or in the back of a shelter. In fact, they're so effective, it'll be almost unbearable inside your shelter, depending on the size of your fire. And also where they're effective as a means of signaling. If you were to stand out in the sun and hold that open blanket out and shake it like a beach towel, it throws off, a huge reflection.
They're also cheap and compact, but I think from what you've said is, well, if you get them, fine, but, practice and do some stuff with them once a year and throw them the hell away and get another one, because if you have it in your kit for a couple of years, it's not going to work.
No, it's not. It's not. Now, I remember reading something a few years back that the British military had tested them and their effectiveness, and they found that they were no more useful than a sheet of plastic. So if that's the case, I'm going to get rid of the space blanket, and I'm going to carry, I'm going to carry some large contractor-sized trash bags. I'm going to carry something similar to that because it's more durable, one, and two, it's going to provide me with the ability to do so much more with it. If I have a, you know, if I have a large trash bag, I can use that in, you know, sky's the limit. You know, your imagination is the limit with that. Whereas with the space blanket, it, you really are limited, with what you can do with it. One of the things that I did with it, I was looking for a way to boil some water. So I lined a small indentation, a hole in the ground, filled it with, some river water and dropped hot stones in it, with the space blanket. Worked great. Also works great underneath your clothing. So if you're out in a t-shirt and jeans and you, you know, it's starting to drizzle or it's starting to get windy, you've got to maintain that cord body dump. So cut that space blanket into a long strips, put it under your cord, underneath your clothes. And, creates a vapor barrier, keeping you warm.
You do bring up an interesting thought, though, when you said earlier the British military said it's no more effective than plastic. I think you're better off with plastic. Then you can carry more of it. You can get a thicker amount of it. You can, it lasts longer. It does more. And when you talk about heat retention there, what it makes me think of is back before the days of, you remember before there was a such thing as Gore-Tex, or even when it first came out, and you're probably like me and too young and poor to afford it, to hunt turkeys and geese and ducks and stuff in the rain, I went out and found this military surplus wetsuit, right? And it was basically a giant rubber suit. And OD green, like, you know, Vietnam era stuff. And it seemed like a great idea. Until you're out there and it's like 42 degrees and drizzling rain and you would think you're cold. Oh, no. Oh, no, no, no. You're wet, cold, and sweating at the same time because the rubber and plastic and rubber retain a tremendous amount of heat. As long as you're doing, like, if you sit still, you'd get cold. But if you were out moving around the swamp, you would literally be covered in sweat. And then when you'd stop, you'd start to cool down because of the conduction cold back through. But if you put another layer on top of that, God, I can't imagine doing it unless I was trying to stay warm. I think that there's a big place for using plastic as that heat reflection tool. So what about some other stuff? I mean, do you have any thoughts on the whole boiling water for 10 minutes, Beth?
Well, you know, I still, you know, even to this day, I see that promoted on a regular basis. People still selling potable aqua tablets. You know, the bottom line is iodine just isn't effective against a lot of the bugs that we have in our water these days. Cryptosporidium in particular, we have, here in the Intermountain West, every summer we have huge outbreaks of crypto, in our communities. People are picking it up down at the local swimming pool, the public swimming pool. This is a bug that's so nasty that the chlorine in our swimming pools and chlorine, bromine won't kill it. And iodine certainly doesn't do the job. Boiling water, you know, you bring that water to a rolling boil and you're good to go. You've brought it to temperature. You've killed everything in it by that point. It's not as prevalent, I think, as some of the other myths, but I still am seeing that.
You got to do it 10 minutes, and if you're at a certain elevation, it should be 15.
Yeah.
But basically, by the time water boils, you start to pasteurize anything at 160 degrees.
Yeah.
And the time it takes for that water to get from 160 degrees to 212 degrees, you've done killed everything in there that could possibly do you harm that boiling will kill. If it's full of mercury or salt, you don't fix that. But as far as biological organisms, if it boils, it's you've done killed it.
Yeah.
Another one that I've kind of been bugged by is and I think this is mostly you talk about there's all different genres of people out there doing this, and I think this one comes kind of like from the eco hippies. Dude, man, you should build like your shelter out of like dead stuff instead of living stuff. You don't want to kill anything. And then I think of this guy with this like, you know, this little lean-to built out of all this dead stuff next to his fire. And I go, gee, if I was going to show you how to build a really big fire, we would do that. And we wouldn't go inside of there.
Okay, so now you're opening a whole other can because, you know, the whole wilderness living You know, I don't want to label the bush hippies because I have a lot of friends who are bush hippies and they're good people and they know a heck of a lot about a lot.
You know, and I want to be fair before you go on. The people saying that are generally not the ones doing it, right? They're the ones that talk about doing it and what have you. So I don't want to be too hard on them either. And you can go ahead now. I just don't want, you know, I'm not, you know, for example, if I would think of like the most famous bush hippie survivalist I could find, it would be Cody Lundin.
Yeah.
And he's not going to be out there building a lean-to out of dried materials next to a fire. And so, yeah, let's qualify that. But that is out there with certain people.
Well, and there's a – in these skills, the bow drill, the hand drill, this debris shelter that you're talking about, these are wilderness living skills. These are not emergency survival skills. And what gets me is I see these skills promoted over and over and over again as survival skills. They're not. I don't know how well you can create a bow drill fire or a hand drill fire, but, you know, I've made hundreds of them, and I still have a difficult time depending on the humidity. You know, the humidity in the air affects your ability to get a coal out of a friction fire. There are just too many variables and you know, the ability to do this, to build a bow drill, first of all, you have to have the correct materials. You have to be, you know, you have to be able to be in the mental mindset to be able to wander around collecting those materials. The right type of woods, blah, 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 and then be physically able to do it. There's just, you know, it's something it's a great skill to own, don't get me wrong, but in an emergency survival situation, it's worthless. It's not something you want to depend on. And it's funny because there's a school of thought out there that says, you know, if you can't get it, then you need to practice more. It's the same school of thought that's promoting the solar still. And if you're not getting enough water out of one solar still, build two, build three. And, you know, what you're doing is you're just digging yourself deeper into a hole and increasing your likelihood of being carried out by search and rescue.
Well, and what I'm thinking is if you had enough material to build five solar stills, you probably aren't in the crisis to begin with. And I think that the concept that some dude that's out there lost is going to have enough material, time, and energy in a caloric deficit, hydro deficit situation to dig five holes and going to have the plastic to build five solar stills is stupid. It's kind of like an interesting parlor trick. Yeah, it works, and yeah, you can do it, but it's I don't think it's very practical.
Oh, it's definitely not. And you know, here in the West, where it's pretty darn dry. You know, it's ironic because the type of soil that works best in is the type of soil that's usually you can extract water from other means. It's just one of those things. Another big thing is I think people, especially people who are into the long-term survival living or wilderness living, you know, learning those type of skills, you know, they refuse to look at alternative sources of protein, food. You know, I've seen this on some recent television shows. I'm not going to name any names, but there are people that refuse to look at any type of alternative means of nutrition other than something that they've shot with their bow or rifle or whatever. Whereas the facts are, you know, people who lived on this land long before we didn't live on buffalo and deer like so many movies portray. Lots of native people who lived in this continent were living off of rodents and insects, and they were finding their protein sources from wherever they could get it.
Sure, and I think that, I mean, yeah, if you can get a buffalo, you take it, but anybody who's a hunter knows it's not called shopping, it's called hunting. And it's not necessarily, I mean, one of the things I was just listening to a lecture Bill Mollison did from the permaculture side of things, he was talking about how they live on all these rodents down in these certain parts of South America where they're still living very much kind of a crossover, local agriculture / hunter-gatherer society. And the way they cook these rodents is they heat up two flat rocks so like screaming hot, and then they grab a little rodent who's probably been like in some kind of live trap, and they just smack him down on the rock. And then they use something to hold the big rock, and they just, smash him in between there, and they make like a cooked rodent pancake. It takes a couple seconds to cook him. And, that's reality. They eat everything, bones and innards and all the hair singes off with these rocks. Sometimes with Mollison, I don't know if he's spinning a yarn or what, but that one sounds plausible.
Well, some of the things we do in our classes is we'll set deadfalls. We use a Paiute deadfall trap because I think it's probably one of the most effective traps that you can build. It requires very little construction, and it has a hair trigger. It's very fast trigger. And
I think it's a lot easier for people to learn than a figure four too.
Oh, for sure. And so what we'll do is we'll set up several of these, we'll look for rodent sign or squirrels, local squirrels. We'll find where we need, rodent trails, whatever. We'll set up along cliff faces and then we'll check them, once a day. And seeing that we have Hantavirus virus and other type of nasty potential illnesses that are carried by the droppings and the mice, I'm sorry, the fleas that live on the mice and the rodents that we're catching, what we'll do is once we have one in our trap, I'll take a stick that looks like a fishing rod with a loop on the end, a little slip knot, and I will pick up that rodent with that. Won't touch it with my hands. There's been many cases of people down in the Navajo Reservation. Typically what they do is when they trap something in that fashion, they'll slip it underneath their belt. They'll carry it right against their body, and the fleas will jump, obviously, to the next warmest heat source, which is whoever the hunter, and will then pass on whatever the illness is that flea was carrying, that rodent was carrying. So we make sure we keep any rodents far away from our bodies when we're taking them back to camp. And then we'll take them back to camp, we'll throw them on the fire, we'll put them on some hot coals, never on the flame, put them on the hot coals, let the hair singe off, and what we'll do is we'll watch it's the anus and the mouth, and its mouth, and once those start to bubble, then you'll know that mouse, squirrel, whatever, is to temperature inside. And then what we'll do is we'll scoop out the entrails so nobody gets a mouthful of that, and then, we'll eat it. And if we have to, what we'll do is we'll leave it on the fire longer and allow all of the moisture to cook out of it. And then, and this is the technique that the Paiutes use here in the desert, they would then take that dried-out mouse, bones and all, they would pound it into a powder, and basically what they were making is a protein powder. And then they carry that protein powder with them. It not only provided protein, but it also provided calcium from the bones, the nutrients were preserved in that powder. And
not to mention fat. So you rabbit myth people, there's your source of fat.
Yeah. And they would
use arrow.
That protein powder would be sprinkled into stews to thicken, and if all you have if you're lean on any type of protein, adding this powder to your stew, your vegetable stew that you've made out of lamb's quarter and whatever else you could scavenge, and then you're adding nutrient content.
Awesome. I got one more myth for you before we kind of wrap up here. I want to see what you think about this one. Moss only grows on the south side of the tree, or the north side of the tree. Not that it even matters.
That's great. You know what? I hear that all the time. We have here in Utah, you know, we have a lot of aspens. Interesting thing is, you get on the aspen trees, a white powder develops on the south sides of those trees. And you can actually take that white powder and use it as a sunscreen. Now we'll take it and put it under eyes, put it under face, use it as a sunscreen, but only is on the south side. And, in that particular case, you know.
That works, but the moss. I had a guy with me, you know, we were taking a walk one day and he told me that and I said, come here. So we were on this, basically we were on the north side of a ridgeline where it's always pretty well shaded. And I said, you see that tree? Tell me which side is which. And he walks around it and there's moss growing all the way around the tree. So I just, the moss on the north side of the tree thing, I don't really get where people even, I guess it can happen in certain environments and the more prevalent side is likely to be the case, but
yeah.
There's better ways to find your direction than that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there's, I mean, come on, that's just simply observing your surroundings, the type of vegetation growing on certain sides of valleys or, you know, there's so many easier ways to determine, I think, your orientation. You know, it's funny, I've seen that myth actually on old Daniel Boone reruns.
I think that's where it's from. I remember seeing that as a kid too, and I thought, oh, that's cool. And I went out and looked in the woods and went, well, that can't be possible because it's not all one direction, you know, it's not everywhere. there are four directions.
Hey, I got one more for you that just I see in every survival book out there. Is the universal edibility test for plants.
Okay, go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay, so you're familiar with it, right? You know, there's a series of steps that you go through to determine the edibility of a wild
break
plant.
Break it, rub it on your skin.
Exactly.
Taste it with your tongue. Yeah, all that crap.
Well, there are a number of plants that if you even put a small amount of that into your mouth, will kill you. And it just is not, basically my approach to wild plants is this, is there are enough out there that are easily identifiable, that are available everywhere. You know, you learn a dozen plants and you'll be set for anywhere in North America, you know. All, you know, pine trees, all grasses are edible. Obviously, dandelion is everywhere. We have most of these things growing in our yard, you know. Instead of relying on some test to determine, you know, that possibly could be putting your life in danger, instead of doing that, go out there and learn a few easy plants. You don't have to pick up a book with 1,000 different plants and expect to learn them all. Learn some basics, learn some easy to identify. Cattail. Who doesn't know what a cattail looks like?
Well, and the beautiful thing about a cattail is it doesn't have a lot of mimics. There's nothing out there that, and I would say dandelion as well. Those are not just well known. They don't have mimics where, you know, we can, you know, talk about death camas for example. And,
yeah.
You know, there's things that look very, very similar and, and then there's things I think people, you know, say there's mimics, but you really have to not know what you're doing to not know the difference between, like, let's say a wild onion and a mimic of that, because a mimic of it looks more like a grass blade. But if you stick to the stuff that's well known and has few mimics, you're going to do okay. My other thing with that is food is seldom the most important thing in an acute situation.
No,
so
for sure.
Risking
for sure.
Eating a piece of plant life, that's, even if it's the right thing, it's only going to have a minimal caloric value to it anyway. When you're in a one-day situation, is probably taking a risk for no good reason. Like with mushrooms, I know several different mushrooms that are easy to identify that we gather from the forest, and that's fine for foraging. But if you're in a survival situation, you don't know what a mushroom is. You're better off to leave it alone because there's very little, you know, caloric value there anyway.
Yeah. You know what? Mushrooms scare the hell out of me.
I can understand that.
I have heard too many horror stories of mycologists taking mushrooms home to their family and killing them.
there's a myth on that one, too, that I absolutely know is false because I've tested it with Destroying Angel, which is, you know, if you want to die, go out and eat a few of those. And it was a myth that was taught to me by my grandparents. You go out and you get the mushrooms. You bring them home and you put them in the pot to blanch them and then freeze them. So you just boil them for a little bit. You throw a silver dollar in there. If the silver dollar tarnishes while you're doing that, there's a poisonous mushroom in there and throw it all away. Guess what? It's never going to tarnish. I don't even know where the hell that came from. So when I was a kid, you know, I'm like, I don't know if this makes sense. I threw a coffee can and threw a chunk of silver in there and boiled up some Destroying Angels, and it didn't do nothing. So, I mean, there's tons of myths out there, and I just say don't rely. If you're not sure, don't rely on it.
Yeah.
Just because you heard it somewhere.
Yeah, and so, and you know, we've got to, you know, I would encourage people to locally go find some. There are enough survival schools and people out there teaching this stuff. Find somebody in your vicinity and go learn from somebody, you know, and not only that, but go home and test it. You know, there's too many armchair theorists out there that are spending way too much time trying to fit their survival kit into a thimble, you know.
Yep.
Get out and do it. Get out and do it.
Yep.
And you will quickly see, just, does this work? Does this not work? You know?
You know, I keep threatening to do this, but I keep just thinking I'm going to get just ramrodded by the armchair ass clowns, as I call them, if I do this on YouTube. I think there are a tremendous number of people out there that if you handed them a Bic lighter in a relatively dry forest, something that maybe hadn't rained for a couple of days, and said, go make a fire, would play hell building a fire with a Bic lighter in their hand. Even if it's not that windy, and even if it's not that wet, that if, you know, they can't do it with anything less than lighter fluid and charcoal, or at least kiln-dried pieces of wood.
Yeah.
And I think that people need to, before you've decided that because you bought a fire piston or a flint steel or learned how to make a coal with a bow drill, before you say, okay, now I can make a fire, as long as I have this on me, can you make a fire? And I know some people out there laughing, but I've seen it. I've seen people, you know, let's say, well, let's go get some lighter fluid. We don't need a lighter fluid. There's some stuff there, and they can't do it. They don't know how. They've never done it before.
Well,
and
fire,
I think in all these skills, you need to practice them.
Yeah, fire is a foundational skill. I mean, you know, there are Aboriginal people who are hunter-gatherers who still are, you know, living today. And to them, fire is life, you know. And no matter how far you go back in our evolution, you know, fire is the predominant tool that allowed us to walk out of the bush, you know, and become what we are today.
Absolutely. And I'll give you a book recommendation. You may have read this, you may have not. It's an old fiction book that is, it's kind of a weird thing, by a guy named Piers Anthony. And it's based on a family that keeps getting reborn in time, starting off like the dawn of humanity coming forward and following this family through. And one of the members of the family is a firekeeper or firemaker. I think the character's name was Blaze in the book, but it's called Isle of Women. And it's really fascinating. Look at history, honestly. And survival in, you know, let's say the pre-civilization eventually gets to, you know, what we would call civilization stage. And it's more of a theatrical thing at that point. There's still some cool stuff in there, but when you get like through the first three or four generations in this prehistoric era, it's really cool all the factual stuff that the guy draws on to tell and weave the story. It's really a pretty cool book.
What was it called again?
It's called Isle of Women. And, you know, it starts out with humans basically using water and trees as protection from predators. And they're on this island, and that's the island that when men from another band are looking for someone as a mate, they go to this Isle of Women to meet a prospective mate. They have, you know, they have the whole thing whether the tribe's going to let them on or not. But it's really cool when it talks about the fire-making component and how, like, the fire-maker, fire-keeper in the beginning was a guy that actually knew how to not even make fire, but acquire it from a natural source and keep it, right? In like a smudge pot type situation. And then, you know, later in the story, he is like a blacksmith, right? So they keep, like, as time progresses, each person's skill set comes forward into the modern equivalent.
And it ends in this post-apocalyptic world where people are living on roaches and algae. But it's really a great book.
That's interesting. That's interesting. And if you believe predominant anthropological theorists, they believe that the man using fire as a tool, actually it was pre-man, using fire as a tool is what allowed us to evolve into Homo sapiens. It was that ability to cook our meat, our protein, that allowed our brains to develop to the point that they are now, that allowed us to reason and evolve into modern humans.
Well, and I'd look at the modern world and I would extrapolate out to say that everything that enables our modern society is energy-based, and all energy is some sort or form or shape of fire. That's like when you talk about your five primary survival needs, and I take that over into modern survivalism and surviving at your house and becoming independent self-sufficiency, I actually just take the fire component and I change it to energy. Because it's a fire component in your home when you have a solar panel that provides electricity. Mm-hmm. That's light. Well, in the wilderness, that fire is light. So it makes sense to me that whether you believe a creationist or intelligent design or a complete evolutionary state, that the argument works anyway.
Yeah.
I say that to stop hate mail.
Smart move.
But send it on, folks. I can take it. It's a typical day for me. But yeah, I mean, you want to maybe wrap up with one thing for, like, I got a lot of people that listen that are in this urban lifestyle and they don't get out there and hunt a lot. So, but they're concerned about preparedness. So kind of wrap it up with how wilderness survival skills, camping survival skills, that stuff kind of ties back in to an urban survival situation.
Well, basically the rule of three applies to wilderness, whether you're in a concrete jungle or in a wilderness environment. They're the same. The only difference is you have a different set of resources. Much easier in an urban environment.
Why do you say that? I agree with you, but why do you say that?
Why is it easier in an urban environment? Because us as human beings are, Western civilized, the culture that we live in, it's easier for us to look at a trash heap and recognize useful tools than it is for us. Our eye hasn't been trained. We've been separated from living close to the earth for so long. We look at the wilderness and we see, lions and tigers and bears. We're afraid. I can go into the city dump and probably, find a truckload of tools.
I'll agree with that. I think that, like, the old joke was, I went out to Montana for my vacation, and the guy, I remember some cartoon, and the guy says, well, do you see a lot of great scenery? And he goes, nah, there are too many mountains in the way. I think there is a loss of the eye, but I would also say I think there's just, wherever humans are, there's waste, and waste is resources. So if I'm out in the Sawtooth Wilderness, there's certain things out there that in a natural state I could kind of use as cordage. I can certainly find plants that I can make into cordage. Maybe I can improvise and use, if I'm smart and I've replaced my bootlaces with paracord, I can pull the cordage out of the paracord, put the jackets back in my boots and continue to have my boots laced up. There's ways I can get by. But if you put me into any urban situation, give me 5 minutes and I'll find you 20 feet of cordage. And ready to go and ready to use. If you put me out in the wilderness, there's ways I can make and improvise a container, or hopefully I brought one myself. Give me 5 minutes in an urban situation, I will find you a container that you can boil water in.
Yeah.
And I think because there's such a waste of resources, there's a ton of resource availability in an urban situation, which I think makes it much easier, especially in a short-term situation. Of course, the other problem is there's lots of other people there, and in a breakdown, then you've got a threat. But if you can put people together and build community, you actually, again, have another advantage. And I think that there's trade-offs with both. I do think urban survival, contrary to the other last myth, I guess we'll talk about, where people are going to run off if the shit hits the fan into the woods with no training, urban survival is actually easier in most instances.
For sure.
Unless there's a nuclear bomb going off downtown or something like that. That's a game changer, but otherwise I think it's easier.
Or a pandemic.
Sure. Sure. You got to break the contact, right? And that's less about urban versus rural, and more about just separation distance between human beings.
Yeah. Hey, have you watched any of that Walking Dead, that zombie show that's been playing on?
No, I haven't seen that yet. Is it any good?
You know what? It's interesting. I'm not a big TV fan, but my son kind of turned me on to this show, and it's interesting to see not only how they deal with the dead, but the social cohesion among the group of uninfected people. And it's interesting. I think it's an interesting play on power, depending on each other, good and bad. I think that's more natural state. I think, you know, no matter how far you go back, we all come from tribal people, people who lived in small family or clan units. They lived close to the earth. They depended on one another. And I think it's our natural state socially, you know, to move
Absolutely.
Back into that if the situation needs arises.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I first started doing the show, I had some people ask me why I'm so optimistic, and I said, because I believe we will rebuild. That's what we do as human beings. And if we took an island somewhere and took a whole bunch of people and dumped them on it and said, you're on your own, fend for yourself, assuming they could get through like the first year and develop some systems and get by and have some root supply to start out with, and then could, you know, kind of build up to sustainability, you'd come back in 5 years, you'd find kids going to school, you'd find a governmental system of some sort, you'd find an education system, you'd find people divided into professions and what have you. And then somebody emailed me and he said, yeah, they call that Australia. And I was like, well, yeah. I mean, except for what happened to the indigenous peoples there, it's not far off.
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer in that, too. The show I liked that they canceled, that I thought maybe they made it a little too comfortable for people to tell the storyline in, but overall I thought was pretty interesting dynamic, was Jericho. I don't know if you ever saw that one. That was out.
No, I never seen that one.
I don't even remember what supposedly, I think it was like a nuclear attack had happened, but it was only in certain spots and they shut down the infrastructure. And it was this little town in Colorado or something like that, and they weren't hit with radiation or explosions or whatever, but all the systems of support were just gone. And they just had to make do as a town. It was pretty interesting, but I think it only made it like one season. But hey man, this has been a great interview, but you've got your school, you've got your shop, your website's at befoundalive.com. Can I hit you up here? Maybe you can do something for our members, for the member support brigade?
Yeah, for sure.
So I'll get with you after the show and we'll get a code set up or something like that. But I think people should check your site out. Again, it's befoundalive.com. And Zach, it's been a great interview, man.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
So, folks, with that, we'll wrap up. Again, can't recommend it highly enough. Get on over to befoundalive.com. I'll have a link in today's show notes. Maybe we'll have Zach on back on in the future, and I'll let you know what he does for you guys in the brigade. With that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Zach Baker, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode. Revolution.